The U.S. Treasury Department on Thursday removed KT Services and Logistics, the MCM Group, SunTac Technologies, and four individuals from its sanctions list, all previously targeted for supporting Myanmar's military, which seized power in 2021 coup.
The U.S. Treasury Department did not provide a reason for the move, and the White House has yet to comment.
You're listening to a special series from the Inside Myanmar podcast, where we're examining a quiet but deeply consequential move. The United States Treasury's Office of Foreign Asset Control, or OFAC, recently removed several Myanmar military-linked individuals and entities from its sanction list. These delistings have sparked urgent questions about accountability, the direction of U.S. foreign policy, and what message this sends both the military junta and democratic resistance. Regional arms trafficking, illicit finance, and rare earth mineral extraction are all on the rise, with consequences that stretch far beyond Myanmar's borders. In this series, we're speaking with lawmakers, legal experts, human rights advocates, and voices from Myanmar's frontline struggle to unpack what happened, why it matters, and what comes next with it. I also have a word to share about this episode that follows in particular. Because of the attorney-client confidentiality, our guest cannot reveal the name of clients he represented and the nature of each legal case. However, he confirmed that out of the four Burmese individuals and companies that were delisted, two individuals and one company are his clients. With that in mind, let's listen to the episode that follows. This is Yi, your host for today's episode on the Inside Myanmar podcast. Today we are joined by Eric Ferrari. He's a lawyer and founder of Ferrari & Associates Law Firm. So one of Eric's specialties is the removal of individuals and companies from the U.S. sanction list. Welcome to our podcast, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into all things sanction, I want us and the listeners to get to know you a bit more. You know, you mentioned that you've been doing U.S. sanction laws for 19 years, right? Like, so how did you first get into this niche of sanction law? Did you always wanted to do? Is this the specialty that you've always wanted to do?
Sure. So when I was in law school, it was right at the beginning of the war on terror. So right after 9/11, and all of the legal issues were focusing on how U.S. national security could be brought to bear in that war. To protect the U.S. financial system, to punish those who had engaged in the activities and the attacks on 9/11. And I became really interested in this concept of sanctions because I had noticed a number of Islamic charities in the United States were being sanctioned. And it seemed like there wasn't a lot of rights. There wasn't a lot of due process. The government had just almost unfettered authority to put people on the sanctions list and seize their assets. And I became very interested in this topic. And from there, I just started kind of researching And I eventually went to work for a law firm that was working on various sanctions matters, including delisting work.
What kind of countries are your specialties with delisting work right now?
I would say the biggest country right now is Russia. I mean, it makes sense. It's one of the largest sanctions programs. We've done a lot of delisting work under the Iran program, parties designated in Lebanon under both counterterrorism programs as well as the Lebanon program itself. Those are kind of the big ones. Previously, DRC, we did a lot of delisting work in that country, in that context. So those are kind of some of the biggest ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So you said you've been in the industry for like, what, 19 years, right? Like a lot of time. And is that, so sanction is your specialty. Do you other do other types of cases from your law firm?
No, we only do sanctions, but not all of our work is delisting work. So we do a lot of compliance related work. Helping financial institutions and companies make sure that they're complying with the law, obtaining licenses for charities and humanitarian organizations to engage in charitable activity in countries like previously Syria, but Iran and other countries that are impacted by sanctions embargoes. Also, obviously, the delisting work we do some litigation with respect to challenging OFAC actions when we believe they're wrongful. So everything has a sanctions nexus to it, but we don't only do delisting work. We do a wide array of sanctions-related work.
It seems like you're the expert that we need to talk about all things U.S. sanction. So I'm so glad that I'm glad that you're here with us to help us better understand the delisting process as well. So the SDN, it's a short for Specially Designated Nationals and Blocked Persons List. So that is the sanction list that you help your client be removed from. So can you tell us what is the SDN list and how does one actually end up on it?
Yeah, sure. So the SDN list is just as you described it. It's a list that identifies parties that have been sanctioned pursuant to sanctions-related authorities, whether it's a statute or an executive order. It also contains listed blocked properties, so things like aircraft, vessels, that sort of thing will be identified on there as well. And the way one ends up appearing on the SDN list is because they have either engaged in conduct or met a status which qualifies them to be sanctioned under a particular legal authority. And there's a whole lot of legal authorities. There's executive orders, there are statutes from Congress, et cetera. So if a person meets the designation criteria under one of those programs, then they can be placed on the sanctions list. And I think it's important to understand the executive orders and these statutes. They have what we call primary sanctions criteria, meaning, for example, you're engaged in corruption in a particular country. And then they have what's called derivative sanctions criteria. It means that you have been materially assisting or supporting persons on the list or acting on their behalf, or you're owned or controlled by them. And then you have what we call secondary sanctions criteria, where you've engaged in significant transactions or provided significant services to parties who are sanctioned.
So then the degrees are like you're the one who's doing it, you're related to the person or the entity that is doing supposedly the what the United States government think is illegal. And then the secondary is it's a derivative from, it's like a next level relation to your connection or like the client's, the person, the individual's connection with the entity that United States deem illegal.
Yeah, but so let's touch on that word illegal for a second, because the US government is not saying these activities are illegal. What they're saying is these activities or these statuses threaten the national security, foreign policy, or economic interests of the United States. It's not that the conduct is prohibited by law of the United States, but rather that these activities harm U.S. interests. And so we are going to identify those parties who are involved in activities or meet statuses that harm U.S. national security, foreign policy, and economic interests, and we'll put them on a list. Once you put them on the list, that's when the criminal and civil prohibitions kick in, and where persons, U.S. persons or people dealing in U.S. goods or services can be punished and commit crimes if they're dealing with those persons on the list. But being on the list doesn't mean you actually engage in any illegal activity, meaning any prohibited activity. It means that you've done something that harms U.S. interests, essentially.
I see. Who decides? Is it a U.S. Government Treasury?
So who makes the decision to put people on the SDN list? It's really a whole of government approach. So the Office of Foreign Assets Control at the Treasury Department is the administrator of the sanctions. They prepare the memorandum. They make the decision to put a party on the list. But they receive information and policy direction from other components of the U.S. government, like the National Security Council at the White House, from the State Department, from the Department of Justice. In certain cases, it might be from other components as well, like the Department of Homeland Security, CIA, Department of Defense, et cetera. So you really have a decision made by the entire U.S. government, with OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, being the administrator who compiles the support for the determination and who makes the announcement. In most cases, State Department in some cases will make the designation themselves, but then OFAC is the administrator of the sanctions list.
So it's an interagency effort that OFAC, Office of Foreign Asset Control, by the United States Treasury Department, administer. So OFAC's the one that determines who ends up on the list, but it is the whole U.S. government approach on deciding who to be on the list, right?
Exactly.
And so let's say, okay, so individual end up on the list because there are reasons to believe that it is harming United States interests. So what happens now? How, how do they find out? And then can they not use their credit card or bank account anymore? What happens?
Yeah, so most people find out just through the news. Because what OFAC doesn't give any advance notice that you're going to be placed on the sanctions list. They'll issue a press release. It'll get picked up by media, social media, et cetera, and it'll be public that someone has been designated. So most people go to sleep at night and then they wake up in the morning and find out the U.S. government has sanctioned them. Or they see a Facebook post that says, so-and-so has been sanctioned. And once that happens, they are completely cut off from the U.S. financial system. So they can't receive any services, any goods, can't deal with any U.S. persons or companies or branches of U.S. companies, for example. But really, that's just the technical legal impact. The real impact is that no one anywhere deals with them. So all of these people who get sanctioned, foreign financial institutions and foreign counterparties won't do business with them anymore because they're worried about getting sanctioned themselves pursuant to that criteria we talked about earlier for providing support and assistance. So it really has the impact of completely shutting them out of the global financial system and making it extremely difficult for them to get any services of any kind. And in most cases, completely locks up their money. Particularly a program like the Burma program, where you'll have parties who are targeted who might have accounts in places outside of Burma. Those accounts are generally restricted the minute someone finds out or a bank finds out that they're on the sanctions list, because they don't want to get investigated or sanctioned themselves.
So the other banks that did, or like people kind of isolate the individuals who are on the sanction list because they're worried they will also get sanctioned if they deal with them.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So now the individuals on the sanction list, how do they get off the sanction list, right? Like, so I think that's where your law firm come in helping with the delisting process. Could you tell us a bit more about how that process works and what's the first step for your clients?
Sure. Right. So there's an actual regulation that is procedures governing delisting from the SDN list. It's in the Treasury regulations. And what it says is that a party who has been listed can present information and evidence why either one of three things is true. Either that there's an insufficient basis for the designation, meaning that there's some case of mistaken identity or some factual mistake or legal mistake. Two, that there's a change in circumstances such that the circumstances underlying the designation no longer apply. Or three, they can propose remedial measures, which if adopted would negate the basis of the designation. In other words, if you're designated because you're providing support to person X and person X is sanctioned, and you can credibly demonstrate you've cut off your relationship with person X and you're not dealing with them anymore, then that could be a basis for removal. Now, again, we noted earlier, I've been doing this for 19 years, and I've worked on more delisting cases than anyone, at least I'm aware of. And what I would say is that that first argument about insufficient basis for designation very rarely works with OFAC. What OFAC wants to see and what the U.S. government wants to see is that the person who is petitioning has either changed the circumstances or made a proposal such that it has addressed or that person has addressed U.S. concerns. So this isn't a process where, like, you would go into court and there's 12 people in a jury and you just have to convince those 12 people. You have to go into the agency that determined you should be sanctioned and convince them that you've addressed all of their concerns. They have a huge amount of discretion. I mean, what the courts have called their discretion is extreme deference to their decision making. And they don't need to actually prove you engage in the activity, and they don't need to prove you met the status. Their legal standard is whether they have a reasonable cause to believe. And they're allowed to rely on any evidence that comes into their possession. So this isn't, again, I go back, this isn't like the parties afforded the same rights you would have in a traditional criminal case or a civil case. You have to go not know what evidence is against you and present your side of the story. And then that information is reviewed and verified by the U.S. government. And it's not just OFAC. It's not just a few people at the Office of Foreign Assets Control. That information is shared with U.S. law enforcement and intelligence communities and agencies. And then those agencies will go to verify whether the information being provided is accurate and true. And those agencies will also look for additional derogatory information to see if that person should remain on the list, regardless if the original circumstances have changed. And I think this is what people don't understand about the process. And I'll stop in 1 second on that. But there's a philosophical nuance here. OFAC is not reviewing petitions to determine whether they should remove someone. They are reviewing petitions to determine whether the party should stay on the list. Okay? And they redesignate parties all the time where the original circumstances no longer apply, but they find other information that warrants keeping them on the list. Sorry, I know that was a very long answer, but I think it was an important one.
Thank you. It's a comprehensive answer. So because it is not just OFAC's, understanding of the individual's behavior, but it is interagency, and the United States government have reason to believe that these individuals and companies should be on the sanction list. I think they're pretty confident that they're not getting it wrong, that these individuals deserve to be on the sanction list, right? So when you do the process of delisting, is there a checklist or criteria that you need to fulfill in order to get the removal from the sanction list for the individuals?
There's not a checklist per se, but I can tell you what I tell the clients, because I tell all the clients the same thing. If you want to go in and argue that OFAC is wrong, we can do that, but we will probably lose. We don't know what their evidence is. Their legal standards, they only have to have a reason to believe it. And they don't take well to you telling them they're wrong. So every party who petitions should go in with the attitude and the posture of, okay, I'm not necessarily admitting to what you've said, but you have concerns about me, and this is how I can address your concerns about me. Because at the end of the day, the sanctions delisting process is not like a criminal trial where you're defending the person. It's really a compliance and remediation exercise where you're identifying what the concerns are, you're taking steps or proposing steps to take to remediate the concern, and then you're presenting it to OFAC for them to determine whether or not it's sufficient to address their concerns.
So how long does the process usually take?
On average, about 2 to 2.5 years.
So in the from the moments that the individuals are sanctioned, and or like I guess like you take on the clients, right? You work on it. So that's the steps. What's the first step? You would provide, I guess, counter evidence to the OFAC first.
It might not necessarily be counter evidence. So no, I mean what we do is we develop a petition. So the petition identifies who the person is, what their current status is, what is their response to the allegations, are we proposing any kind of remediation, and that's pretty much it. So we're kind of setting out why we believe we sh- should be delisted, and also providing basic information on employment history, who the biographical information, whether or not they have any assets in the United States, if they're any, subject to any legal proceedings. And then after that, we're responding to the allegations contained in the press release.
Thanks for explaining the basics of the SEN list and OFAC. And, you know, recently on July 24, four individuals and companies from Myanmar are recently removed from the SEN list. And that includes a few of your clients, if I remember correctly. You said that two individuals and one company from Myanmar were your clients in helping them removed from the sanction list. So for most of us who are not really a part of the sanction laws or well-versed in sanction laws, there might be some confusion whether, you know, your firm would help lobby or actually like the in the ways that it would help the individuals be delisted, right? Like you just mentioned that it's the process of petition and a process of helping in writing in documents to send to OFAC for that. And if there might be some confusion between a lobbying firm and a law firm in how that would help an individual get removed from the sanction list, if you could clarify the difference for, I guess, like for common people like us.
Sure. Yeah. Lobbying is that you're going into or before the U.S. government and seeking to influence their policy. You could do that through presenting information to any manner of government official. And the idea there is you're speaking to decision makers to try to change a decision or to get the U.S. government to adopt a policy. That is not what this is at all. As a matter of fact, lobbying is not permitted for sanctioned persons. If you look through the enforcement history of OFAC's website, you'll see that lobbying is prohibited and people have been prosecuted for lobbying. That's not what this is at all. This is a legal service. We are representing parties in a legal administrative proceeding before the Office of Foreign Assets Control. That's not lobbying. That is presenting information on paper through a website, not through a website rather, but through an email address, getting written responses in return and engage in a back and forth written dialogue with the agency. And they are serving as the adjudicator, as the party who's reviewing the materials to see if the designation criteria no longer is satisfied. So there's no going into the White House and having a conversation. There's no going to Congress and saying trying to drum up political support. Everyone thinks this is a political process. It's really not. It's a legal process. It's on the paper before the same people who put you on the list, determining whether or not the delisting is appropriate and warranted. Did that make sense?
Yeah. Thanks for clarifying. And then you said that it's lobbying's influence on the policy, but law firm is representing in a manner that will help remove them. I guess I'm more like administration side. Is that correct?
Right. Well, yeah, lobbying is with respect to policy regarding, you know, Burma more generally, right?
Right.
In this case, the legal proceeding is a proceeding by which you're following a legal regulation and you're meeting the criteria of that legal regulation so that the administrator of the proceeding can review the information and make a legal determination. It's a legal process. It's not about whether the person is a good person or not. It's not really about whether or not, you know, this is a great thing for the United States or that the military in Burma is not that bad. None of that is part of this process. This is, you guys have made these findings and these conclusions about this person. And here's information to either say, one, you made a mistake, which, as I mentioned earlier, is not a popular thing to say to OFAC, or two, that the circumstances have changed, and here's the evidence for that, or three, I propose to do the following things to address your concerns, and hopefully they satisfy you that the findings and the determination have been satisfied. So that's the difference. It's not about to influence people through relationships and dialogue. It's going through a legal proceeding where you're addressing the actual findings made against you to impose the sanctions in the first place.
Thank you. Thanks for clarifying that.
Sure.
And you mentioned on your public LinkedIn post that in your 19 years of working on sanction law, you had this first time you got triple removal action. So two individuals and one company removed from the list all at the same time. So that is a big win for you.
Yeah, I think it's a big win. And also, people may not like to hear this, it's actually a win for sanctions, because if parties are not being removed from the sanctions list, that means there have been no changes in behavior, which means the sanctions have been ineffective. And people might not like delisting because they don't like the people who are being delisted. But the idea of imposing sanctions in the first place is to get people to change their behavior and to address the concerns that these persons' activities or statuses have for U.S. national security interests. And so when a party is delisted, it's not because they have a great lawyer. It's because the United States has determined that the delisting criteria have been satisfied and the designation is no longer warranted. So I was celebrating that as much as any personal success that I had from the removal action. I mean, if you go look through my LinkedIn over the years, every time someone is delisted, we say congratulations to them and to our team, because it is so hard to get persons delisted, because it is so hard to convince the United States government that the circumstances have changed or this person no longer represents a threat.
So you're saying that the reasons the individuals or companies are removed is because of a change in behavior or circumstance. But in this case, you know, not just a lot of Burmese people, but, you know, United States Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights in Myanmar, Tom Andrews, also said that the companies removed from the sanction list, you know, they have been implicated in brokering weapons and materials for the regime's military operations. So the UN Human Rights Special Rapporteur have reasons to believe that there is actually no change in circumstance or behavior. With that, I think that is where a lot of anger and hurt come from many Burmese people. Because, you know, a lot of Burmese people in the United States right now, they cannot go home because after the 2021 coup. And also they are victims, direct victims by the actions of the military regime. So to see that these individuals who are, I guess, like have reason to believe have close ties with the military regime that directly inflict hurt on them, be removed, it caused a lot of hurt and sadness in many Burmese people. And with that, I think I see some of them are angry towards the individuals being removed from the sanction list, and some angers are towards you for representing these clients that you have helped remove. So, you know, what are they missing that you wish they would understand from your perspective? What would you say to them?
Yeah, the first thing I would say is I've let them come onto my LinkedIn page, say really awful things about me and to me. I haven't deleted them. I haven't reported them. I haven't blocked them. I'm not in any way saying they can't be angry or they shouldn't have an opinion. I'm in no way saying there shouldn't be a Burma sanctions program. I'm in no way, shape or form trying to say that their concerns aren't justified. But what I am saying is that we went through a years-long investigation before the same body that imposed the sanctions to address the concerns of that agency, and that the entire United States government, in coordination with its law enforcement and intelligence apparatuses, investigated these people, investigated the information we provided, and two administrations, because this started under the Biden administration, two administrations did not believe that denying the petitions was warranted. And while they may feel very upset that people were taken off the list, and that's a step backwards, if parties are not removed from the sanctions list, it disincentivizes persons from engaging in changes of behavior and addressing OFAC and the U.S. government's allegations. I know this because for almost 20 years, I've been representing parties on the list, trying to get them to conform their behavior and their actions and address seriously the allegations that have been brought by the United States government. And when that fails and they don't have anywhere else to turn to because they don't feel they're getting a fair shot before OFAC, where does that leave those persons? That leaves those persons going right back into the arms of the persons that the U.S. government didn't want them to dealing with in the first place. So if we're going to make it so hard to remove parties from the list, and we're going to get so upset, and we're going to attack the lawyers of the people representing them, as well as the people themselves, it's going to create an environment where no one can get off the list. And if no one can get off the list, then no one is going to address the U.S. government's concerns, and no one is going to distance themselves from the actual sanctions targets in the first place. So look, if everyone wants to beat me up and say that I'm a terrible person and all this stuff about I'm, you know, enabling genocide and I have blood on my hands and all this stuff, if that's the way you feel, I'm sorry you feel that way. My goal here is to make sure that parties understand what the requirements are for removal, to give them the opportunity to present their side to the U.S. government. And then from there, the U.S. government makes a determination. If I was able to get everyone off the sanctions list, then I probably would have retired a long time ago. But most people get denied. That's the reality. Most people who go through this process are denied. So after 3 years, the United States government investigated these petitions, investigated the other derogatory information, and made a determination that the sanctions against them were no longer warranted. Sorry.
So then you said that this is a legal proceeding that you help facilitate for your clients. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not well-versed in sanction laws, but I mean, the only parallel I can think of right now, it's like having a criminal defense lawyer who's representing, or like in some movies, they would be like, oh, I don't want to know what you did, but my job is to defend you in the court of law, right? Like, do you feel that way about this like sanction law case in that sense of like how, with, like, does it matter what your clients did or did not do, but you have to represent them?
No, 100%. It matters what they did and what they didn't do, because my job here is not to go into court and say, regardless of what they did, they should be let go. My job is to go in, and if they have engaged in the conduct, which has been identified, or they meet the status, which has been identified, our job is to remediate. Okay, so we have to investigate everything. This is not criminal defense. I've defended people criminally. Okay, I've gone before a jury and said the government didn't do its job, and that's why this person should be set free. That's not what happens in this process. You don't get that level of rights. You don't get that level of independent review. You have to go in and credibly demonstrate that you have addressed, to the satisfaction of the same people who sanctioned you, their concerns. So this is very different. And so at the beginning of any case, we go in and we say, all right, what have they said about you? And what else is being said about you? And client, is that true or not? Yes or no? Okay, it's true. How do we change that? What can we do to prove that it's never going to happen again, or it's not happened and we can prove that it's not happening? Like, it's really about remediation and addressing concerns, much less so than a criminal case where you're saying this person should be innocent of the crimes as charged because for whatever reasons. They're two apples and oranges, really.
Thanks for clarifying that. And also, you said that the removal of these individuals from the sanction list proves that the process is working, that it is a good thing. So you think that is a more of a technical, like a standalone case, that this happened right now? Or do you see like a change in the political climate in Washington, D.C. that would indicate anything, whether there's been more removal, less removal, or like, does it mean there will not be more people listed on the sanction list because they start removing? Does it indicate anything at all?
No, it doesn't indicate anything from the policy perspective at all. Like I said earlier, these delistings have been pending since the Biden administration. So two administrations have taken a look. and determined that these people shouldn't be on the list. So that's one. Mm-hmm. Two, there is no discussion that I'm aware of rescinding the executive order to get rid of the Burma sanctions program. There's no information I'm aware of that they're rolling back enforcement or targeting under the Burma program. So this is just like, this is a process that relates to these specific individuals and companies and the specific information that they provided and is reviewed on its merits. It's not an indication of any kind of broader policy change or anything.
Yeah. I think that's also some of the concerns for some of our listeners, Burmese audience too, you know, that does it mean that we're going to start seeing a lot of individuals removed from the sanction, which in the court of public opinion, they probably don't deserve. I also noticed that the sanction law, I mean, are they different with each administration, or is it just like the executive order that started in the Biden administration, does it still continue into the next administration?
Yeah, so it's the same executive order. It continues, but every year the government, the administration, has to renew the declaration of national emergency. So the way the president invokes his authority is there's a statute, and the Congress has given the president authority under the statute upon declaration of a national emergency regarding a threat to the national security, foreign policy, and economic interests of the United States, that he can use these sanctions for a one-year period. And so every year that the sanctions program exists, the president goes and says there's a continuing national emergency with respect to the threat identified in the executive order. So the sanctions continue. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then the, so let's say the sanctions are removed. What happens now? Can they just like start using the credit cards now? People start dealing with them now? Because some of the individuals that were removed from the U.S. sanction list recently, they're still on other country sanction lists, like UK, mm-hmm. EU, Switzerland, different country sanction lists. So what can they do now that they are delisted, that they couldn't do before?
I can tell you that I've had clients who have been delisted who weren't sanctioned elsewhere in the world, who for years and years and years afterwards, like in one case, 7 years, were still not able to get bank accounts because of their prior designation. So this idea that like, okay, the person's off the sanctions list and now they can do all this business and, you know, go back to doing whatever they were sanctioned for, that's just not true. I mean, it's not reality. It's the fact is that these designations, even when they're removed, the consequences linger on and on and on. And the fact that they were once sanctioned continues to be reported by business intelligence databases. People, and particularly financial institutions, particularly large global financial institutions, continue to make risk decisions to not deal with the persons because of their prior sanction status. So it's not as if a light gets turned on when someone is removed.
So the purpose of the OFAC sanction is that's not punishment, right? They want to see a change in behavior. But I feel like in court of public opinion, some people think these individuals are deserving to not have access to certain things that they do, which could cause a change in behavior, kind of like force their hand to do that. So with that, even if they're delisted for change in behavior, you said that it takes years for them to start getting access to the accounts, getting to do things that they couldn't do before. So how, for this removal of the sanctions from the SCN list, was the State Department in an interagency discussions between removal of these for this particular case?
They must have been. I mean, I didn't have any engagement with the State Department on it. So they are generally consulted on these kinds of matters, that they are part of the interagency. They're heavily influential in that process. So I can't say that they definitely were, because I wasn't there. I don't know. I didn't talk to them. I don't know what happened behind the scenes, but they should have been.
Yeah. Now, so when a person is on the OFAC sanction list, their assets are frozen. Mm-hmm. What does it really mean? Like, is it like somebody take the money, or the money just sit like that and they can't use it anymore?
Yeah, the money just sits like that and they can't use it anymore. Yeah. And there's a difference. Anything that's under U.S. jurisdiction is actually blocked. So there's a blocking report that's filed with OFAC that says, you know, we're a bank and we're holding this much money that this guy has an interest in. And then that money just sits there until the party's removed. Then there's money that's frozen or restricted. So that could be someone has money in an account at a foreign financial institution, and that bank is just not letting them use the money. They're just restricting it because, again, they're worried about being sanctioned themselves.
The one last point I want to ask before we get to a close is that how can you be proactively go on to not get on the sanction list on the first place? How do individuals have reason to believe that, oh, I'm about to get on the sanction list, or is it just out of the blue, or is there anything that they can do to not get on the sanction list?
Yeah. So one, I tell clients all the time who are worried about getting sanctioned, how seriously are they addressing the allegations that are being made about them? So these don't come out of the blue generally. There's usually NGO reporting or media reporting that says, you know, this person is tied to this sanctioned person or engaged in this kind of activity. So I tell clients all the time, you need to view, even if you're outside the United States, you have nothing to do with the United States, you need to view it as a compliance exercise, and you need to take what people are saying about you seriously and address their concerns. And if appropriate, communicate those concerns to the Treasury Department so that they're aware that if you are being investigated for sanctions, that there's either a change in circumstances or that you've proposed some remedial steps to, you know, exit a business relationship or exit a particular industry so that you don't get sanctioned. That's not always effective, though. I mean, it does work sometimes, but it shouldn't be ignored. You know, I tell clients all the time, if an NGO is reporting about you or if Bloomberg is writing about you, et cetera, you should take what they're reporting seriously and have a very sober conversation to determine what you need to change or how you can address these allegations so that they're not used against you. And you demonstrate to the U.S. government that, hey, either it's not true or I've changed it, or I am going to do something so that you know I'm not engaged in this activity.
Is there, you take a lot of clients on different tricky cases in terms of, you know, the UN reports or people say that these individuals did things, and then, mm-hmm. you know, within the process you have to defend or like put in legal proceedings that they didn't or they have changed the behaviors. Mm-hmm. Is there any type of clients or any kind of clients that you wouldn't take for moral reasons?
If a client came to me and said, I did all of this stuff and I don't want to change any of it, I want to continue to do it, I wouldn't take that case. But if a client came to me and said, look, I didn't do it, and let's figure out a way to demonstrate, you know, whether it's through auditing or forensic accounting or like some hard document, documentary evidence that can be produced that I didn't do it, or, okay, I did it, how can I change my behavior, or what can we propose so the U.S. government doesn't think I'm doing this anymore, I will take those clients on. Because again, this process is not about defense. I mean, you just used the word defense, which I think people commonly use. This process is about ensuring compliance. And so my job as an OFAC lawyer is not necessarily to defend a party. It might seem like defense, but it's really to ensure that we've brought their conduct and their status into compliance with the United States government, United States government's expectations. So, you know, to date, no one has wanted to pay me money to just present information to the United States so that they can get off. Everyone who goes into this process understands that if you lie to the United States government, or you omit information from the United States government, which is material to the determination, they can prosecute you. And our clients, when we go through this process, go through the process with the understanding they have to tell the truth to the United States government, or it's going to be much worse for them. They're going to get denied. At best, they'll get denied. At worst, they could be criminally prosecuted for lying in this process. And I'll be honest with you, not everyone who talks to me wants to hire me, because they don't like that approach. But that is the approach. And the reason we've been successful is because we understand the legal standard here is about bringing parties into compliance with the law, not trying to find some way to get around the law, as people online are now suggesting.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside Myanmar Podcast. We hope you liked what you heard today. And if so, you might be interested to know that over the years, we've built an extensive archive that now numbers in the hundreds of episodes, all of which are freely available to anyone who wants to listen. Our latest estimate is that it contains well over 360 hours of interesting, thought-provoking, even inspiring content. That's 15 days of continuous listening for those willing to forego sleep and want to go from episode number one until the one you just heard. In other words, there's a lot there. These past interviews, they capture the stories, struggles, and triumphs of Myanmar's people, along with the insights of foreign allies and observers who've played a role in navigating these critical moments. There are also more than a few discussions covering spiritual journeys thrown in as well. Together, our archive forms a rich tapestry of perspectives documenting pivotal points in the country's history and offering a deeper understanding of its complexities. However, producing episodes and maintaining this archive takes a significant investment of time and resources, and we rely on the support of listeners like you to keep it accessible. If you found value in what we offer, whether through today's episode or a deep dive into our past discussions, we invite you to help us sustain this work. Your contribution allows us to maintain and continue expanding this archive, as well as producing new episodes free of charge to all. So consider making a donation at insightmyanmar.org/donation. Oh, ba, yara nanda, yara nanga, 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 yara nanga